So we've talked about Padma's birth and where he arose from. Yeah, it's on. His birth, where he arose from, and his experience of being taken off into the palace. It's a long story, and it's a very complicated story, but he does leave the palace. And he does go through all sorts of different teachers, both human, non-human situations. He gets burned alive a couple of times, comes back to life again. You know, a pretty adventurous life, really. And this goes on. One of the towards the end of his quest. He spends time in cremation grounds, so that's what I want to look at for the next half hour or so. His life in the cremation grounds. In order to put this in context, just let's remind ourselves what Buddhism is all about. We could say that. One of the essential doctrines of Buddhism is the Four Noble Truths. That goes through every school of Buddhism, recognises the Four Noble Truths. The first of these truths is that we suffer. We experience suffering. That's a fact. It's a truth. The second truth is that the reason we experience this suffering is because of grasping. Grasping hold of things which, of their very nature, are impermanent. And that's what gives rise to suffering. It could be objects, it could be situations, it could be people, it could be ideas, it could be mental states, it could be all of these things of increasing subtlety. But it's the grasping hold of things, the grabbing hold of things, that causes us suffering. The third noble truth is that we can be liberated from that suffering. And the fourth noble truth is the way to that liberation. And in essence, we could say very briefly, what that means is let go of the grasping. Yeah? Instead of grasping things, let go of things. Give things up. If you give things up, then that is the way to nirvana. Now, this is tricky, because we think that when we give things up, we're giving up things that actually make life worthwhile. But what we're doing is we're giving up things in order for a greater value, for something even more valuable. I mean, I was talking earlier about Lake Dharmakosha, about that kind of level of consciousness, which is unbelievably positive, delightful, you know, pleasurable, satisfying, everything. And it's because it's beyond thirst, it's beyond grasping. Unfortunately, we have to let go of the grasping before we can experience that. And that is where all the yes buts come up. You know, yeah, I agree with that entirely, but hang on, you know, what about my iPad? Sort of thing. So, you could say Buddhism really is about letting go and learning to let go in different ways. In the Vajrayana, In the form of Buddhism that's concerned with images and symbols and direct experience, the place where one lets go most radically is the cremation ground. Yeah, we've all got it coming sometime or another. Unfortunately, we don't have public cremation grounds in this country. It's a great spiritual disadvantage, but we are nonetheless going to finish up there one of these days. So it's something we're all going to meet. What the yogis used to do still do actually, is they go to cremation grounds. They sit at night in cremation grounds and get as close as they can to their own death, really, which is giving up everything. And what happens if you do that is you meet the Dakinis. Now, I'll say a bit more about the Dakinis in a minute. But they are extremely, well, when you first see them, they're terrifying. But when you get to know them, they are utterly blissful. So this is what Padma did. He went to the great cremation grounds of India and he meditated there. There are actually 8 great cremation grounds. And the reason there are 8 is because in the Yogacara philosophy, there are 8 consciousnesses. There are 8 realms of consciousness. There's the 5 physical senses. So there's a cremation ground, if you like, for each of those. There's the letting go of each of the senses. In a way, you have to let go of the senses in order to even taste Dharmakosha Lake, because that is not in the realm of the senses. It's in a mental realm. So you have to let go. There's 5 cremation grounds for each of the 5 senses. There's 1 for the mind consciousness, for the thinking consciousness. There's 1 for the ego consciousness, and there's 1 for another consciousness, which is even deeper than that. So what these 8 cremation grounds represent is going to a place where you try to experience what it's like to really let go of different aspects of one's grasping in a quite sort of fundamental way. As you can imagine, they're terrifying. It's frightening to think of letting go of the things that we really value. So the initial impression of these cremation grounds is of terror, of fear. So the images of the cremation ground are quite frightening. However, as we hear about them, you'll see that within there are elements of liberation. There are elements of a much higher state. Anyway, let's hear about, I think it's 3 or 4 of those cremation grounds, and then I'll make a few comments.
Canto 33. The sojourn in the cemetery, pile of the worlds, where he received the name Dorje Dradog. Now there is in the land of Uddiyana the large cemetery, lotus pile, having a circumference of 1.5 leagues. In the centre is a stupa which arose alone and is self-luminous, where dwells the great Lamia Puskasi. In the southeast is the marvellous tree of the tombs, the mango, frequented by many sinister birds. In the southwest is the dark green lake of the water of the tombs, where fish of the tombs multiply. Nearby are the sepulchres and the frogs of the tombs, and the many white daughters of the Gandhava, who devour all the dead from the water of the tombs. In the northwest is the funeral fire, heat which burns the site. And in the midst of the fire, many daughters of the god of the wind, with flesh yellow and white, mounted on heifers, brandishing skeletons. In the northeast is the funereal wind, great amplitude, and in the gusts, warriors covered with armour and doing battle. In the east, on the mountain of the tombs, beautiful Tuf, many fierce creatures of the tombs sleep. In the south, multicoloured darkinis of knowledge are writing and reading, meditating, explaining and predicting on the 3 yogas, treasure of the inexhaustible Dharma. In the north, the multitude of gods of discrimination assemble. In this cemetery of terror, Padma, with his back to the stupa, turned the wheel of the Dharma for 5 years, and the white Dakini Shantarakshita, covered below with trousers of white cotton, holding a bowl full of blood in her hand, and having a garland of dried skulls tying her chignon, remained kneeling before Padmasambhava and learned how to wish for the union which saves. Here he received the secret name of Senge Dradog. Now, in the cemetery piled up black clouds, the noble guarantor of perfect joy appears as Vajrapani. He manifests in a brilliant form, a luminous body which one cannot touch. His untied hair is held back by a piece of blue silk. In his right hand he holds a golden vajra, and with his left he rings a silver bell. Thus, from Vajrapani, who was like a segment of the rainbow, Padma heard the perfect tantra of the Anuyoga. He also heard the 9 general tantras and the 15 special tantras. He also heard the 10 or so 100 particular tantras and the 8 sections of the Gukya Mula Garbha Tantra. He heard many other tantras and the appendices explaining vows. And the full Darbha embracing the sacred canon, all of which Vajrapani masterfully blended together. Next, Padma came to the land of Khotan, to the great cemetery pile of the worlds, having a circumference of 3.5 leagues. In the centre is the self-rising stupa, Kheusa, where dwells the great Lamia, the lady of the charnel houses. In the northwest is the marvellous tree of the tombs, pleasant abode, where venomous coiled serpents, surrounded by the swine and the birds of the tombs, all feed on the flesh of children. In the northeast, in the fragrant lake of sepulchral water, the swarming creatures of the water eat other creatures. Some skeletons, some moribund, some fleshless, some already half devoured, some still alive to be eaten from top to bottom, and the young girls of the Kumbanda skin all the dead creatures of the water of the tombs. In the southeast, in the fire of the funerals, white and black boars vomit out skeletons. In the southwest, in the obituary wind whirling, the genies of the sun, mother, son, and brother take refuge exhausted. In the north, the living king of the mountain of tombs projects like sparks a quantity of fireflies. In the east, many creatures of the tombs are there, some dead, others ill, others convulsed with agony, others as skeletons, others deeply cut with arrows, others full of life, others in their youth with apparent riches and treasures of gems. In the south, Balang, with the face of a bull, a leopard fur on his black body, a long javelin with a skull in his hands, and a makara, brilliant like a fish, on his back, mounts a white swine with a cadaver in the guise of a saddle. And in the west, mounted on an ox, red Kali, a noble lady, holds a trident and a skull filled with blood and devours human hearts. Now, in this great and terrible cemetery, sojourning 5 years, Padma turned the wheel of the Dharma for the Dakinis, and he received the name Dorje Drolon. Of the history, unabridged, of the lives of the Guru of Uddiyana, Padmasambhava, this is the 33rd canto, the sojourn in the cemetery lotus pile, sealed oaths. Next, the saint arrived in the land of Sala, in the great cemetery of the mysterious apparitions, which has a circumference of 3.5 leagues. In the centre is the self-rising stupa, Kapata, dwelling of the great blood-drinking Memo. In the southwest is the marvellous tree of the tomb's golden security, the fruits of which are eaten by many creatures of the tombs. In the northwest is the water of the tombs, the lake most excellent, which is frequented by many creatures of the tombs, including the daughters of Nagendra and the daughters of Yakshas, who look like cadavers. In the northeast is the funeral fire, cloud of smoke, and in the whirlings of the fire are male and female demons who eat the carcasses of men, of horses, of oxen, and of still others, and who play at countless games. In the southeast is the funereal wind of five origins, and among the wild shadows are dissimilar creatures without number, none dead, none being born, none aged. In the west, on the mountain of the tombs, descent from Titans, live lemurs of many kinds, without poverty, possessing treasures of miraculous gems. In the north there is only one form, the goddess Sahadara, yellow in colour, wearing a wild fur, tearing rotten tree trunks high and low with both hands, and carrying on her back the yet moist heads of men. She mounts a black sheep with a skeleton for a saddle. In the east, the white lady of things, mounted on a corpse, moves by elevating herself. Here, among the terrors of the charnel house, with his back against the stupa, Padma made the wheel of the Dharma turn for the Dakinis for 5 years, and he received the secret name Tertrangsal, strength of the rosary of skulls. Of the history, unabridged of the lives of the guru of Uddiyana Padmasambhava, this is the 34th canto, the sojourn in the great cemetery of mysterious apparitions. Sealed oaths.
Okay, so it's, if you've not read that before, or heard that before, it's probably quite, quite terrifying. It's quite a frightening sort of image, and you might wonder, well, what's all that got to do with Buddhism? You know, Buddhism is such a sort of peaceful, sort of gentle religion and so on. But it does actually, as I was saying earlier, what the Vajrayana tries to do is represent experience. It sort of covers all aspects of our experience in the spiritual life. And there are going to be times when it's going to seem quite frightening. Perhaps not quite as horrific as that, but there will certainly be occasions when one can feel that one is in that kind of situation. Because, as I was saying earlier, the main project, in a way, of the Buddhist life is letting go. It's giving up. Stopping grasping hold of things. And this, as I was saying earlier, also is quite a frightening thing. So this kind of text, in a way, recognises that fact. It recognises the fact that it's a kind of a difficult thing to do. The yogi who goes to the cremation ground at night sits amongst the funeral pyres, even in a perfectly kind of regular cremation ground. You'd hear the kind of, you know, the dogs and hyenas, the pigs, all the kind of wild animals sort of snuffling around in the jungle. And, you know, if you're sitting there, if you're meditating there, when all this is going, maybe there's a few fires still burning. Maybe you can, you know, every now and again, there's a flame flies up and you can see the bodies lying around. You can smell the flesh of the bodies all sort of roasting and so on. And you sit there and you meditate. I can imagine that you would experience ghosts. You would feel that there were things creeping around in the night. You would feel things both in your own psyche and outside in the world that could be, you know, quite frightening, quite as horrific as some of those descriptions. I mean, sometimes in dreams, don't we? We see these terrible things. So these images do present themselves to us. And the thing is to stay there, to sit there with it, to experience those things, and to recognise that they are, well, they have no ultimate reality. They are just a representation, in a way, of one's own fear, of one's own terror. And that by sitting there, experiencing that, staying with it, you can overcome it. You can overcome that fear. And then something else happens. There's a famous line of Milarepa's, another Tibetan saint, who says that learning to see nothing, something is seen. So it's a bit like that, learning to recognise that these images, these terrors, that we experience, maybe not as vividly as that, but we experience them ourselves in our own ways, in sort of lesser ways perhaps. I mean, it's probably been times when you've walked in a dark wood at night or down a dark road and, you know, you're convinced there's a mad axeman just sort of not far behind you. So many friends of mine that have been on retreats have reported mad axemen coming to their hut and tapping on the window, you know, tap, 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 tap. You know, I've got my axe, tap, 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 tap. You know, in the morning, sure, they discover it was just a tree hitting against. But you experience your fear that way. So this is what the Tantra is about. The Tantra is about experiencing those more frightening, more negative parts of our own psyche, sitting with it, not reacting to it, not sort of running away from it, not trying to fight back, but just experiencing it as the terror of our own minds. And then what happens is something else opens up, something breaks through, as it were, into something else. And what does it break through into? It breaks through into a relationship with the Dakini. Our Dakini, traditionally, is a female figure. I think it's worth remembering that most of these yogis, certainly not all of them, but a lot of these yogis are male. So a lot of the imagery in the Tantra is sexually polarized. I think one has to sort of get used to that. So what appears is a female figure. She's strange. She's probably red, bright red. Sometimes she's black, sometimes she's white, sometimes she's yellow. But her whole body is one colour. She's naked because she's completely open. Remember, she represents the freedom that comes from having faced these things. So the Dakini represent. I think of her as the sort of the door that you go through. You know, you're approaching, let's say, some degree of freedom, some liberation from something or another, and there's a fear. You don't, you know, there's part of you that doesn't want to be liberated from it. You want to stay secure, even with that old thing, even if it's not very pleasant. But then once you've gone through that door, once you've accepted that, then you experience the liberation. And to me, the Dakini is the image that represents that. So she's both fearful. You know, she's red, she's got long black hair, she's dressed in skulls. She's holding a skull cup in one hand. She's holding a dagger or a chopper in the other hand. She's quite frightening to see. She's terrifying, certainly intimidating. And yet, she's also ecstatic. She's very sexually attractive. She's liberated. She flies through the air. She has no worries about anything. The reason that she's naked and her hair is wild is she's not restrained by anything. So this is an image of freedom. So she has got both these qualities of being somewhat frightening, somewhat intimidating, but at the same time intensely attractive. There's something really, really attractive about her freedom. And the image kind of incorporates these two sides, both the terror and the liberation. So this is she. There are many different varieties of darkenings. You know, almost there's a darkening for every grasping. So everything that you graft has got its darkening. Some of them are not so spectacular as others, but they're all there. So Padma goes to these cremation grounds and he sits with his back to the stupa. So what does this mean? The stupa is originally it's a funeral thing. It's something that's built over the funeral pyre, but it's also come to represent the elements of the human body. So it's almost as though Padma is sitting with his back, with his with a little bit of support from the fact of the primal elements in his being. He's resting on those, and this will give him a bit of kind of stability during this relationship with all of these creatures. And the darkenings appear, and they either give him teachings or they sort of convey powers to him or something like that. And the other thing is he gets a new name. He's given a new name. So he can say that when he goes into the cremation ground, it's like there's part of him that's dying. He's letting go of something, so that part of him does actually die. And he experiences the liberation that comes from that, and he gets a new name. He's a different being afterwards. He becomes somewhat different to what he was before. And again, this is the kind of process we can go through in our own lives when we give up something. Quite often, of course, we give up things involuntarily. You know, something is taken away from us. We don't particularly want that, but if we can accept it, then that is a renunciation. A friend of mine once said that she got home one day to see her house on fire. She lived in Australia, and I guess it was a wooden house, and the whole house was burning up. Everything that she possessed was burning up. And she said she just sat in the garden watching it all burn and felt utterly liberated. Yeah. Now, that's not the experience everyone has, but in her case, that is what she experienced at that time. So letting go of all of that stuff. There was a whole load of relationship stuff associated with it as well, I think. So it was kind of an enormous part of her life she'd let go of, and she felt incredibly liberated as a result of that. Okay, I think that's what I wanted to say, really. I'm talking about the cremation grounds as images of renunciation. We were talking this morning about renunciation. It's not a popular thing. It's a tricky word. Giving up things, letting go of things. We can think that there's nothing going to be there. But that isn't the case. The case is that as we let go of things, we experience greater degrees of freedom, which is deeply satisfying, provides deep contentment.